Before we get started, have you ever wanted to visit the land down under? Australia is a hotbed of innovation and has a thriving entrepreneurial community. And the heart of that community is Fishburners. Fishburners is a co-working space in Sydney, Australia, which is home to the single largest community of entrepreneurs and business people in Australia. If you're thinking of coming to Australia for a visit, or if you'd like to try working from Sydney, start your trip at fishburners.org. They have a range of membership options for all kinds of businesses and individuals, and they host regular events where you can connect with some of Australia's most influential business people. Next, do you need a single phone number that comes with multiple extensions so anyone in your company can be reached no matter where they are, even if they happen to be in Australia? Go to grasshopper.com. It's the complete virtual phone system that entrepreneurs like me love. Next, do you need a lawyer that's not the local guy who doesn't really get startups, not the really expensive guys who want a piece of your business, but one who really understands the startup community and is there to help you? If you do, go to Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. All right, let's get started. Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner, and I am the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And, you know, I'm always very proud of the work that I put into these interviews. And frankly, sometimes I even boast when I know more than other interviewers about my guests. But the only way to be able to do that, honestly, is to also admit sometimes when I don't know. And in this interview, I'm going to do that right off the bat and say that I've got Scott Fennell here. He is the founder of Level 11, which creates strategy and executes the strategy it creates. I've got a page here of pre-interview notes, and I've done a little bit of research, and I still don't know enough to say that I am fully in control of this interview, Scott. So here's what I thought we'd do, as you and I talked before the interview started. I just come in here and let you tell your story and ask questions to help me understand it as we go along the way, as we go along. Starting with, first of all, thank you for doing this interview.
Absolutely.
And second, are you embarrassed to be here when the host himself does not have it fully together and has not done all the research you possibly can?
Not at all. Isn't that part of startups? It's always adapt and pivot.
Yes. You know what? There's a part of me that always says, what if you don't know as much as you want? Because I'm so proud of the research. And then I said a while back, look, if you don't know it, that's what being a pro is about. You figure it out when you don't have everything. And so that's what I'm going to do right now. Look, to give people an understanding of what you do, I thought we can talk about School Technologies, the company that you were telling me about as we were getting set up. What did you do for School Technologies?
Okay, so Schooling Technologies was founded in the 80s.
Yes.
It was one of the very first DOS-based operating systems in high school and K-12 cafeterias. They did everything from the point-of-sale systems, the cash registers, into the back-office inventory management. And they were the market leader from 80 to the late 90s. In about 2000, they started pioneering essentially prepaid credit card technology, what you think of as when you swipe at Pete's. And they started trying to solve a problem in food, which was children who were on the free or reduced lunches were literally getting food tickets, like a food stamp, and they weren't eating because of the social stigma. So what they went to is they built out a student ID where the kids with paid or fully paid lunches have the same card as someone whose parents were buying the lunch backed by a Visa, MasterCard, or debit card. And that removed the stigma of free and reduced lunch. They were in about 21,000 school buildings across the country in K-12. We then took that company, the founder wanted to exit. He was nearing his 60th birthday, wanted to exit by 65. We repositioned the company both from an R&D perspective, from a capital table perspective, and then refined this meal lunch ID card program. They called that My Lunch Money, and positioned them for sale. And in short order, 18 months later, we sold 65% of the company to an $800 million publicly traded company that was in the credit card space, and they wanted the credit card transactions. So it was a very strategic buyer. And then there was a go-forward joint venture on the remaining 35% of the company to expand the Lunch Money program across the rest of the U.S. as the credit card company rolled up the space.
What do you do? Can you give me an example of what you did to help that company grow so quickly?
You know, beyond the cleaning up the cap table and doing the work to make the financials and the book ready for sale, it was literally thinking of new strategic markets and partners to expand the My Lunch Money program. So it looked like aligning them with the studios and aligning them with Fandango to actually go in and say, we're going to create a program where if you ate healthy, 10 apples, since we controlled the point of sale, we could tell what the kids were buying. We were then able to give them rewards such as iTunes gift cards, movie passes, and things like that for eating healthy. So we were able to get them true corporate partners tied up to eating healthy and then ran it through the entire technology. So we invented that new corporate partnership and leveraged that to extend the reach across.
Oh, I see. Okay. And that kind of gives me a sense of what the name Level 11 means, but I know that it has an interesting background. How'd you get your company's name?
I'm an ex-entertainment lawyer. I spent 16 years doing strategy for studios and record labels. Level 11 comes directly from Spinal Tap. It's the scene where the amps go to 11, and we always thought that was a fun pun. You know, accelerating companies to the next level, pushing them over the edge. And if you look, our logo is actually a stylized Marshall amp, cranked to 11.
I didn't catch that. So you were an entertainment lawyer, and then something happened in 2002.
Yes.
You were a winner, right? You had a good verdict.
A great verdict. It was about a 7-week trial. It was at Rancho Cucamonga, for those of you that don't know that. That's the high, kind of high desert of Central California. Mm-hmm. And the verdict came in on a Thursday night, and I had to drive back to L.A. and realized I did not want to own a law firm and go back to work on Monday morning, despite a 7-figure verdict. And I walked in on Monday and said to the staff, we're going to shut this down and not renew the lease next September. Wow. I had no game plan, but knew I was burned out emotionally. And if I don't care what my client's success is, it's time to move on to something else, because you've got to be invested with your clients.
Why not? What happens when you do so well and you still can't get yourself excited about the job? How does that happen? I want to avoid that for myself.
I think you have. For me, it was pretty simple. I had made so many deals for studios and labels for their benefit. I got paid to do it, but I wasn't an owner. I wasn't an operator. I wasn't involved, because as a trial lawyer, you have to be a bit dispassionate and disconnected to be objective. Mm-hmm. And I wanted that attachment with my projects, that, oh my goodness, I really want this to work emotionally, which is different than the dispassionate lawyer verdict when money shifts from pile A to pile B.
I see. And you had some really interesting work. You worked on Star Trek, Power Rangers. What did you do? And then we'll go back to how you started Level 11. But what did you do for those great brands?
So we would do global brand strategy. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of franchises express themselves in a number of consumer-facing vehicles: film, soundtrack, television, merchandise, toys, games, learning, stage shows. And so a lot of that was devising their intellectual property strategy, figuring out how we were going to license that, how we were going to protect that, and then how we would make it global, because the rights and the way you roll it out in the U.S. are very different than what you might do in Asia or in Europe. So it was really that 100,000-foot, 5-year planning of working with these kinds of global franchises in these various different marketing models. They all have different business models, mm-hmm, and different expressions. And studios tend to work in silos, at least they did historically. You had the film group, the television group, the music group, the merch group, etc. And rarely did all those groups come together to really architect out a 5, 10, 15-year forward-looking plan to make it cohesive. And so we would come in and really make it take a cohesive look at what you did with the franchise and how you expressed it to the consumer.
So that's the kind of work that, first of all, you can be personally proud of, but also you can talk about and have people recognize it. You know, it's not like building obscure parts in obscure machinery that maybe it's worth a lot of money, maybe it's helping a lot of people's lives, but no one understands it. Here you have work that everyone else understands, and you go from that to spending a year doing nothing in LA, where so much of what you do is who you are in other people's eyes. Can you talk about some of the difficulty of being in that limbo period?
Yeah, that's a great question. That was probably the hardest piece of the transition. My only job had ever been a lawyer. I graduated law school, went straight to work, and mm-hmm, so now I'm 30-something years old. I'm trying to do the math. And my identity had been tied up as a lawyer and had no clue what to do. I remember the first few months, I would ride my bike up and down the PCH, and I was freaking out because my cell phone wasn't ringing, and I didn't know what to do with the silence. and I didn't know what to do with the non-busyness. And I thought, no one will ever take my calls. This will never work out. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't have a game plan. And it took about 6 months to really reconnect with me and realize my identity was not my day job.
How do you do that? How do you, because the way that you just described your mindset is not, it's not a fertile environment for creativity and a great business idea. So how do you turn around your mindset so that you can come up with this business, so that you can come up with something worthwhile?
I think that's partly what frustrated me about being a lawyer. On the trial side, there's the rules of evidence, et cetera. That's pretty governed. But I really love the creative part of figuring out what to do with a brand, a product that was truly a whiteboard. So one of the things I did is I went to a website, I forget which one, that literally wrote your resumes for you.
Okay.
I had these guys write me 10 resumes for completely disparate jobs, a marketing director or whatever, just to understand what skill sets were in common, like a Venn diagram. And one of the things I figured out was I loved the whiteboard creative, creating something out of the air. And I went out and bought some whiteboards and I started just making stuff up just to see how that process would work again.
What was up on that whiteboard?
That's going back years. At the time we were working on Sirius Music, Quicksilver Records, but we had figured out a play in Hispanic fitness where we were going to take a celebrity and launch her on an infomercial out of Sports Club LA. And so that model was kind of being started by Zumba at the time, and Zumba had just entered, but there was no real space of integrating health, wellness, nutrition, music in Hispanic at that point in time. So literally I kind of did it in real time in that project, and we figured out who needed to partner in and how we would distribute that and how we'd learn it. At the same time, we started looking at different spinoffs of that company, which looked like Hispanic databases, a marketing company, and an ad agency, trying to figure out how to actually aggregate that data. So my whiteboard started out into one thing I knew well, music, and one thing I knew nothing about, Hispanic marketing. And the trick to that was bringing in a bunch of people that were experts in it and getting out of their way, which taught me how to collaborate. Very different than being a lawyer.
And so the first thing that you did was you started creating a company.
Yeah.
Not investing in other people's companies, not buying something else, but starting something from scratch.
It was, a client of mine owned two small labels, was in the transaction to buy three more, asked me to look at it, and then look at it morphed into run, operate, take this over, and then buy some more companies. So I'd never run a label, but I had to get into the weeds and understand how one actually operated a record label. And the second project was concurrently this Hispanic project. So we were doing two startups concurrently. We had two different staffs, one office, and we ran them day in, day out, back to back.
And was this in LA, or I saw also that you had an office in Paris?
This was all in LA. It was actually on Lincoln Boulevard, Lincoln right by Rose. About 2 years later, we started the first anti-doping agency to compete with WADA. Mm-hmm. And that was a brand new business model, which actually was run out of LA, Century City. And then we did have offices in Paris because we were doing so much of the doping and cycling out of Europe. So we actually had to have offices in Paris.
So how do you end up with an anti-doping agency? That's not the kind of thing that would come to you out of the blue.
The trick about one of the things I did is I played tennis in college, and then I became an Ironman athlete. And I had been a cycling pro sports freak most of my life. Mm-hmm. A couple scientists had an idea for a new way of testing doping on a different piece of science. And they came to us going, help us figure out a business model. And I started with, let's do this in a business model, and then morphed that into co-founding and co-running the Agency for Cycling Ethics, cycling. So I had to get into the weeds and understand the science, and it became a really fascinating journey into medicine, science, and how your body works.
Wow. Now, how do you manage all these different kinds of companies where you have to fully understand each business, where you have to figure out where the customers are, how to persuade those customers, how to find your partners? I think most people, most entrepreneurs, myself included, when we're focused on one business, there are enough challenges. But when you throw in a second business, it feels like a distraction. And a third, we feel like we're in chaos. So what do you do to keep it all organized?
chronologically, we had sold off those first two companies before we did SiteOne.
But I see.
You think back to what a trial lawyer does. My job is to take a very complicated piece of technology, a business model, a something, mm-hmm. and translate that to a jury, and then advocate that.
Okay.
So for me, getting into the science and getting into the weeds on technologies I didn't necessarily understand was very similar to the path I had done for the first 16 years. The expression of it is a B2C play, which just has to be done in simple English. So I was actually well suited for that, having been a trial lawyer. I didn't know that, frankly, until about 5 or 6, after we had done that 2 or 3 different times. But for me, the engaging part, the emotional connection is, I love learning about new technologies, and I love getting into the weeds, and then I also love bringing in experts to teach me. So it's a balance between getting into the weeds to understand it, and then stepping out when the experts come in and say, let's do it this way. It keeps focusing on core competency. Stick to your core competency and build the team.
One of the things I found in interviewing people who do that is that they have a way, they have their own way of absorbing just the right amount of information, of figuring out what information they're going to care about, figuring out how they're going to get it accurately and absorbing it and not getting distracted by everything else. Did you have a practice like that?
I do.
What is it?
Again, it comes out of trial lawyers, right? It starts with, if you think of a trial, Studio One, V2, mm-hmm. There are 50 issues. But the truth is you disagree on 3, and the rest are the periphery. You just focus on the 3. So when I look at a new piece of technology in business, first thing I do is break it down on a whiteboard and figure out what's absolutely essential, the must-haves versus the wish list.
Okay.
And I try to spend my time as much as I can in only the must-haves and delegate the wish list out to the staff so that I understand what they're doing, but I don't understand the detail. And I focus on 2 or 3 areas: the business model, the distribution, the scale, the strategy, and then let the team come together weekly and communicate and explain to me how they're going to execute that part of it.
I remember when I talked to Tim Ferriss, he figured out what those key areas were for him, but he didn't do it alone. He went to talk to others who were experts in what he wanted to know, and then he had them tell him what those key areas were that he should focus his energy on. How did you figure out where those right spots were for you to spend your time?
I knew I was good at global strategy, and I knew I was good at kind of connecting a lot of disparate dots. Mm-hmm. But I do, as Tim suggested, when I bring in a physicist or I bring in a subject matter expert, one of the first questions I ask is, give me the 100,000 foot lay of the land, then tell me what I have to know. I mean, I actually go to them and say, okay, help me understand the basics so I can talk about it. But just like Tim would do, I would then go in and say, okay, what don't I need to know? Where do I have to spend my time and attention? Where do I have to focus and translate this out to the world? Because you can't know everything about any startup you're doing, really.
I see. So Scott, if I wanted to emulate you, or someone listening to us wanted to emulate you and said, hey, I'm going to start hiring. Well, to hire, I need to focus on a few core areas and let the rest of my team focus on the rest. I can't figure out what those areas are. I'll go and talk to people who are good at hiring, maybe other entrepreneurs who hired quickly or at my pace, and ask them, what's key for me to spend my time on and what should I delegate to everyone else? Is that the approach that I would take if I were to follow in your footsteps?
There's probably a step before that. Strategically, I would go in and say, okay, we're going to launch company X, and it has 10 jobs. We've literally built companies in Excel where we would go, okay, here are the 10 skill sets required. We put them into buckets, and we start allocating roles and responsibilities without someone hired. Bring the experts in, fill those expert positions first, mm-hmm. and that generally takes 3 or 4 of the slots out of the list. And then you're pretty clear on what's left. We bring the experts in right up front and have them help us understand. And then I can go out to my buddies and say, I need a CMO to do this or a CTO to do that. But it really is road mapping out the vision of the company, road mapping out the strategy, and then the bandwidth necessary to execute that. Once you define the bandwidth, it's pretty easy to figure out who can fill that bandwidth.
Okay, so then if you are producing fitness videos, as we talked about earlier, what's key to succeeding in that business?
First thing I did is I hired someone out of Univision, a Hispanic director, a Hispanic producer, and an all-Hispanic staff. And I had them produced the entire thing in Spanish as the language first, not English. I myself, the least knowledgeable person in the room on the act of producing, and I made myself the knowledgeable person on how we would ultimately market it. So I literally did the whole thing, if you will, backwards. And we did it in Spanish first with true experts. And I just made sure I understood enough of the process and frankly learned enough Spanish that I could communicate. My staff was bilingual, but turned it around and let them demonstrate core competency in their native tongue. Because I didn't want my sensibility to interfere with the director's or producer's vision and execution. I'm not a Hispanic female, so I don't exactly know what that video should look like to reach them.
All right, what about getting into Walmart? I heard you got in there. How do you do it?
We had, it came out of my relationships. We had been pushing studio product and content across all of the big boxes. And so we knew the guys that were distributing in and said, you know, here's an idea we have. We showed them the demos and we targeted Walmart's in Hispanic dense populations, frankly, and we did the basic testing. The shortcut we had is we knew who was putting video into the stores, who brought that into Arkansas, delivered it to them, got them on board. Part of what I do is try to build alliances and try to build partnerships. So I actually made the distribution company more of a partner than a vendor, and then said, if you guys are comfortable with this product, I want you to take it in. If you're not comfortable, don't. But I wanted them to be invested in that piece.
How do you keep those relationships warm? I mean, you're talking about going back to a previous job and talking to people who are connections of yours through a different company. I'm trying to think even in my own world. Someone who I interviewed a year ago may not even remember that we talked, even though we might have had a deeply intimate conversation where they talked personally about their life, let alone if I contact them a year later and say, hey, I'd like us to work together. I don't know that it would be any more than a cold connection with some kind of past history that the other person vaguely remembers. So how do you keep it warm?
Our audio broke up there. There's a couple tricks there. One, I have a very good memory, which helps.
Okay.
Two, I take an awful lot of notes in my computer at all times about who, where, why, and what I know. I've got form files and relationships that go back 25 years. And so I make a point of, you know, keeping in my orbit a lot of my friends, even if it's just checking in social, because a lot of my friends now run studios and run companies and do things like that. So it's really a combination of just making the effort to stay in touch. And I know that is extraordinarily difficult, but I focus on that because if you build good relationships and you're willing to do the work to maintain them, you will always get the benefit and so will they. And one of the things I try to do is be of service to those relationships. So I don't really call up my friends and say, here's what I need from you. It's much more about, boy, what are you working on? How can I help you? Who else do you need to know? What can I do to make your life better? That tends to keep even peripheral relationships a little closer.
What about those notes that you said that you take? I take notes all the time on conversations. Right now I'm doing it on paper. I don't know why. Often I'll do it in Evernote. Sometimes I'll do it in Google Docs, but maybe it'll be my personal Google Docs or maybe it'll be my work, but Google Docs. I have what is this program called? CoBook, which I love for keeping track of notes in my address book. All these different places. What do you do so that you don't get it all lost, and so at the end of a conversation, what you remember stays with you at the start of the next conversation?
It's a great question. So I use Evernote as well, but pre-Evernote, let's just go backwards. One of the things I had to learn as a lawyer is how to compartmentalize all of the email, all the clients, all the files. So I have built a very clear system in Mail where my emails filter into buckets by client, by project, etc. That matches into my Dropbox, that matches into Evernote. And so I can go backwards and tell you who worked on a deal 11 years ago in about five clicks.
But you have to search in all three of those places.
No, they're all synced. They're actually all worked together. So frankly,
interesting.
Once I typed up your name, the way my Dropboxes are set up is literally a mirror of my email in my hard drive, which is then backed up offline. So literally, I spent years as a lawyer figuring out how to basically use metadata and organize it, and I made the practice happen in all of my computers. So whenever I get a new computer, an iPad, a phone, or whatever, it's already set up that way. The discipline in that is you've got to file your inbox rigorously. You've got to file your work in process box rigorously. when you type up notes, you've got to move them into the right place. But if you do that, it lets you go extraordinarily quickly.
And so at the end of a meeting with someone, what would you do to make sure that you remember what you talked about, remember something small about him or something really important to him, like that he ran an Ironman or that he loves gingerbread cookies, so that you remember for next time?
So there'd be two sets of notes out of that meeting, right? There'd be the meeting notes.
Yep.
We talked about X, and then there'd be something in Evernote or somewhere else that says, you know, Mark ran Ironman and did a 10:31 in 1989. Just little placeholders.
See, and then the next time, because the way you file it, it's all available to you.
Yeah. I could type his name back in. The true meeting notes would show up, and the observations would also show up. You flip it on your phone before you walk into the meeting.
The fitness video company that you had, you sold because of something that happened to the talent. What happened?
Yeah, we shot the first two videos and all the promos. And at the time, she had a 5 or 6 year old child. And right before we got ready to shoot the third video, she got pregnant and had been told by the doctors, you know, after the first child, because of the complications, she would never have another child. And got pregnant, and you know, it was exciting. She and the husband and the son were totally elated, and we had to figure out what to do, because I would lose her for the 3 to 6 months during the pregnancy and at least 3 to 6 months after. And that also changed her focus. So we had two real issues. One, we couldn't film her, and two, she really decided that it was time to be a mom again with a newborn. And you can't keep pushing the rock up a hill. I mean, that's a great family decision. You've got to endorse and fully support that. And it made sense just to move on to the next company. She had some success, and you willingly go forward. You know,
who did you sell the business to?
We split it up. So parts of it went overseas because they were pushing the videos into Central Latin America. So spin out of Fox. The videos in the U.S. just continued to be distributed, and Fox picked up some stuff out of Miami. But they really wanted to push the content essentially into Central and Latin America. So it was pretty easy to spin it out into Mexico City and move on.
And you did something cool before I move on from that story. You did something interesting for getting testimonials for those videos so you could sell it. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. One of the things we did is, so it was clearly an infomercial you could see on TV. And when people started buying and selling, you would obviously get their contact information. So we would run call centers with ourselves and actually call the first multiple rounds of clients with ourselves, me, the talent, and the team, just to get feedback and say, hey, we're introducing ourselves, and because the community is very tightly knit. We are going after very specific markets. So we literally went in and got feedback personally, even though the calls placing an order were truly through a call center. We went back and actually maintained contact with our clients. We also did email chat and some very early online chat to let them actually do a Q&A with the talent. It was trying to personalize it, which was extraordinarily hard in 2004, 2005.
And you couldn't have them do testimonial videos on YouTube, but you did ask for just interviews.
Yeah, because we were kind of ahead of that piece of technology. There really wasn't a lot of this social media that we could engage in real time. It was just kind of coming out in 3, 4, 5.
What's the next big project that you worked on? Was it, where is this? I'm still looking at my notes. That thank God for Jeremy Weiss, who did the pre-interview here. Monterey Jazz Festival, or is that a little earlier?
That was back in the record label. So one of the things we did is we had bought the rights through an acquisition to what was Monterey Jazz and repurposed it, remastered it, redid the liner notes, brought in a bunch of experts. It was a fascinating exploratory company. And then I didn't know much about jazz before, so I had to go get a couple guys, ex-Rolling Stone guys, a couple guys here to teach me jazz, and then figure out how to repurpose literally hundreds, if not thousands, of hours in a manner that worked to two markets. You had the audiophile market, the guys that are jazz aficionados, and you had guys like me that wanted to understand the basics of jazz, and so we tried to express it in two different ways so that two different markets could be reached, because especially some of the early Monterey Jazz in the late 60s, early 70s was extraordinary experimental music. And I didn't really know what I was listening to. And it certainly wasn't accessible to someone like me. And so we had to figure out how to package it in a way that you'd understand you're listening to this legendary guy in a vamping session, you know, kind of going off the cuff. It's just really great to learn about an entire new genre of music.
When you don't know the music that you're listening to, can you be as open as I was at the top of the interview, or do you have to pretend that you get it, that you feel it, that something in you is changing?
No, I live in a whiteboard. I mean, if I don't start a strategic project with a truly blank whiteboard, I think I'm doing something wrong.
I see.
If I've got a predetermined outcome of whatever that project is, then that's going to affect how we think about strategy and begin to even sketch it out. So I'm pretty comfortable living in the space called blank whiteboard, because that's kind of our job, is to figure that out. And so we know you want your business to be successful. I mean, there's a couple outcomes we know, but the path of how to get there, if it doesn't start pretty blank, I think you wind up unconsciously shifting or driving a business because of some driver that's in your process.
Mm-hmm.
So I call that remaining agnostic. I try to remain as idea agnostic as possible through the process and then implement the strategy to the numbers. You know, what are the real world implications? And let the marriage of qual and quant kind of help drive the direction rather than me saying it goes like this.
Can you give me an example of a business that you were in that if you walked in with a vision for where it was going to be, that you would have taken it in the wrong direction instead of listening and letting it decide for you where to go?
Oh, I can think of probably too many.
Really?
Because so many times our clients will come in, or even a startup will come in and say, I'm trying to think of a really concrete example. We worked with a software technology that did some very early on 3D modeling around like architecture. And they had come into the space trying to do a certain approach in dorm rooms. And they were going to try to work in that space. And they didn't realize the software could do 10 or 15 other things. And if we had kind of said, great, we've got these relationships with the universities, et cetera, let's push down that path, they would have missed the opportunity to be the backbone of a Crate and Barrel or an architectural firm or a CAD design firm. So one of the exercises we would do in a company like that, that I think all entrepreneurs should do, is let's say you've got a short list of 10 things on the whiteboard and you've got some basic come-to-market strategies. We go through the exercise of force ranking them with the founding team and go, okay, let's pick two or three. To our earlier point, you can't do 10 things at once. So when we create strategy, it is truly an engaged process with the founding team. It's not us telling them what to do. It is literally in rooms late at night, banging around and figuring it out and remaining as agnostic as possible.
That's such a challenge. I mean, Scott, it's not just a challenge as an entrepreneur to figure out where the business needs to go, where your customers want it to go, where the opportunities are, as opposed to where you want to shove it. I mean, even in conversations, just a few weeks ago, I did an interview with Mark Echo of Echo Unlimited, and I had to admit to him at the end of the interview that what I wanted from this interview was for him to be the hip hop artist designer who was going to tell me that when he sold his business, he bought a jet and had, I don't know, tons of women on the plane with him and all that. And we both recognize how silly that was, because for him, it was a whole different experience. And it's tough. It's tough not to impose your vision sometimes on situations.
It is. I mean, but maybe the background I had as a lawyer is what gives me that ability, because a trial lawyer is what, a director, a producer, and an actor all at once, right? You are the talent, you're talking, you're directing the order and the flow of the witnesses, and you're producing the event, how everything happens. Back to that transition period, the act of letting go of that control was the hardest piece of transition. And now 10 years later, I don't like having control. I like being able to be just part of the process. I orchestrate the process, but I'm not certainly dictating the result, because the result has to be collaborative. Otherwise, you might as well do it as a subchapter S and start it up yourself and not take advice.
Right. What did you do with software in retail idea? What was that? The one where you're helping people get fitted ski boots using an iPad?
Yeah, that's one we're launching right now. So it's called Number 9 Software. Number 9. It's the founder's son's soccer number. So we try to come up with names that have some personal touches where possible. He had owned a ski shop, and we learned that the process of fitting a ski boot or a ski is actually A, complicated, B, hard to replicate. So we took in the cloud, in iOS, the expert rules, the steps, and we actually mapped out the 10 or 15 steps it takes to fit a boot from beginning to end, express that in dial down Windows scroll menus, and actually built in the cloud the algorithms that support the decision making, and then itemized the process so that you could actually walk someone through on any iOS device. And from that, we've come up with 8 or 9 other types of verticals. The same process works: a running shoe, a tennis shoe, tennis rackets, golf clubs, and all these kinds of items of sporting goods that require some modification. And then we backed it into rental and service of those things, we have electronic records, as well as product recommendations, real-time synced inventory. And then to make it more engaging for the customer, most manufacturers make these great videos on skis and boots. We actually pull those down from the cloud, and so while the customer's walking around in those boots to see if they fit, they're actually going through the manufacturer's videos to see their product in action. We found that to be a great engaging tool.
Oh, that's cool. And you guys pre-book some sales from that?
Yeah, we got into that company in about, the beta was released in November of last year. Mm-hmm. We went to a ski show in Jan-Feb, won some Best in Show awards, and it launches in October. We've already booked nearly $100,000 in revenue in about 60 different boxes. We're currently on a sales trip in it right now. Spent about $150,000 on developing the software.
One of the things I've found from interviewing people who do pre-sales is that it's not just about the money in the bank that gives you some security. It's about validating your idea and getting input on how to build it from people who are really willing to pay. Did you get any of that here?
Absolutely. One of the first things we did in December was we went to about 16 shops that we didn't own or control and literally let them play in the alpha beta versions for free. And they were using it in retail in the real world, all in exchange for feedback and all in figuring out what worked, what didn't, where we had to change the UI, the UX, mm-hmm. and kind of get into their experience of it. And it's continuously going through that process with them without charging them a dime. Because what we think works, back to being agnostic, right? If I think it works, but you're the consumer, have a different experience, I've got to understand your experience. So we went out to people we didn't even know and said, please test this for us.
So do you have an example of something that happened to the product, the way it was changed because of those interactions?
Oh, yeah. We never envisioned up front writing a service mode, meaning how you service tickets waxed by skis. Mm. We saw that coming as a preview of coming attractions way down the line. People were clamoring for it immediately, a work order system. Another one, we are pushing and pulling SMS back and forth. We did not realize that stores with multiple locations actually still use paper. So, for example, if you're in Mammoth or Whistler or someplace, there may be 5 or 6 ski shops, but all the repairs may be done in one. And what literally happens is there's no inventory real-time tracking. So at the end of the day, 50 pairs of skis come from store 1 to store 2.
Okay.
They have no idea to deal with the workflow. They have no idea when it's going to be done. And so one of the things that the software immediately did was alleviate that. The real-time workflow happened, and because we had customers' SMS and contact information, we can ping them messages saying, your skis are ready for pickup at 9 a.m. at this shop. We knew that was going to happen. We had no idea major mountains would clamor for that immediately, because it actually solved communication gap intra-store and certainly external to shops. And so we immediately started building some of those verticals out when we were thinking it was 12 to 15 months down the line.
Oh, wow. You know, I can't believe still that there are companies that operate based on paper. I just assumed everything had gone at least to computers, if not to mobile.
I thought so too. Certainly their inventory is computers, but if you literally think about going in and buying a pair of golf clubs, if you golf, I mean, you stand there next to the pro, he hands you the 5 or 10 clubs, you swing them, and at the end of the day, there's literally a PO written down, right? I bought this club and I'm changing this grip. You've taken all that and put it into the cloud, so it's part of your permanent record. They're still writing those modifications down by hand because they have to go back to a manufacturer who tweaks it. It's still print and fax. And
fax.
Well, think about it. If you buy a pair of Callaway golf clubs from XYZ retail store and they have to be modified, they're probably being modified at Callaway, San Diego. So somehow a piece of paper has to get to San Diego to get your work order done to get the clubs back to you in Santa Monica. We pushed all that up into the cloud.
I still, you know what I have to say, that there are times when I still use, where companies want me to use fax, I end up going to hellofax.com. I think it's run by a few Mixergy fans, and so that helps. That helps me get around that. I don't want to forget to ask you this. In fact, this was going to be one of my first questions, and I kept getting distracted, but I want to ask about the watches, your passion for them and the significance of the watches.
Remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, when private equity guys would fund deals and you get those tombstones on your desk?
Yes, my boss on Wall Street used to have them, and in the worst way, I wanted it, even though I didn't know why. Right.
Right. I grew up in that world where I would just see all these tombstones, and I would go, wow, that's kind of really cool, but it, at a certain point, became paperweight. We had no money when I was a kid, and I'd always wanted to have, you know, a real nice watch. And so one of the things I started doing was when we closed a transaction or do something that's significant, I will go out and buy myself a nice watch. And so I currently wear the watch every day of our first major close in 2005 for a couple reasons. One, it reminds me on a daily basis of where I was at and where I've been. Try to use that to keep myself humble and, you know, on beam, on point. But it's kind of a fun reward. And frankly, when we do startups, we do the same thing. We usually buy the founding team a fun gift at launch. Just something to commemorate that launch day. I'm trying to keep startups personal and trying to keep these guys emotionally invested in the act of a gift, even if it's a $30 gift, $100 gift, it doesn't matter. Really, I think, sets milestones down to remember where you were. I've heard that from too many of my mentors. One of my mentors is a guy who was literally a homeless at 17. He dropped out of high school and was living in a shipping container, a literal shipping container down in Orange County. And 25 years later, he had sold X percent of his company to BlackRock for, you know, 30 plus mil. And he bought a piece of land down in Dana Point, and across the bay, I guess is the way to describe that, was the plot of land where his shipping container was. And he bought a little piece of that land and put a shipping container there. And every morning he goes out and sits in his backyard and looks at the container. And he said, Scott, that is one of the things that keeps me grounded. And so the watches work for me to keep me grounded.
I get it. And do you celebrate it like, did I understand it right? Every 12 months you celebrate it like a birthday?
Sort of, yeah. I really do. I have a reminder in my calendar that reminds me various things of milestones in my life. The first time I paid off my debt, some of those things. Celebrate may mean just an acknowledgement and a 5-minute meditation and gratitude or doing something nice.
The day that you got rid of all your debt, maybe sure. I wouldn't say a birthday, but more like an anniversary that is on your calendar that you stop and you say, appreciate where you are now because you were deep in debt. There was a day back then where everything turned.
Yes. And I literally show that up as a 12-month calendar reminder, and I take 5 or 10 or 15 minutes and I try to do something to acknowledge that. I have to look at my calendar. I don't remember it out of my head. And if I do that, it'll show up on the video. It's in March.
Okay.
And I want to say it's in the teens of March, about 5.
I hate celebrating my birthday. It's July 4th, which I like. It's a good day, but I hate it. I didn't do anything. When I was reading the notes in preparation for this interview, I thought, I should pick a date that's significant to me and remember that. And it's not like I'm a curmudgeon who doesn't want to celebrate. I just don't want to celebrate something that I had nothing to do with. I want to celebrate something like getting out of my debt or finding freedom in my life. And I'm thinking back, there's October 2013. That's the big day for me. That's like a new birthday when I got done with my first company and I was able to take off and do whatever I wanted. I should go find out what date that was and make that my new personal birthday anniversary.
I think so, because if you can't, like, birthday's a bit of a fiction, right? Just like I think a lot of things are fictional. We put significance on them because you're supposed to, like a holiday. If you don't take a little time to sit back and reflect on something that may mean nothing to the rest of the world but you, I think you get arrogant, you get complacent, you get lazy, and you're certainly not giving back.
Yeah.
And so I just picked that. I didn't do that. I did it consciously the first year. It's become a tradition. I think when I did it the first time, I didn't believe I'd still do it 8 years later. But it is, yeah, it is my day. And one thing,
2003 for me, 10 years from, we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary, so I better go find it and use that as a celebration. But before I go, I know that we're running out of time here. Maybe we've gone a little more time than we planned, and I planned on, and I appreciate you staying for it. But how did you get so deep in debt that it became a celebration, a life-changing moment for you when you got out? What happened that you got in debt?
You got to realize how you shut down a law firm, right? You've got existing clients and existing run rate. Mm-hmm. Cases run, you know, 12, 18, 20 months. So you can't take on new work if you've got a date you know you're shutting it down on. So your run rate's going when cases terminate or they settle or whatever happens, you're not bringing in new work. So the delta starts to separate very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Between revenue and expenses, yeah.
Sand. And then, you know, I had done those two startups and I hadn't really fully exited them yet. So I had taken huge pay hits to get into the record business and to get into the Hispanic business. So my lifestyle and my life had still been, you know, lawyer, take a 60 or 75% pay cut, try to figure out what you're going to do. You start leveraging. Like every entrepreneur, you just get into that place where I believe in this and I'm willing to run the course to try to get to that point when I don't have to. So it was pretty straightforward math. You can't sell a law firm like you'd sell Mixergy. You just exit.
And you know what? The other interesting thing is you were 38 around that time, right?
Yeah.
You're not a guy who's 21 years old. You're not a guy who hadn't tasted success. Boy, to go from where you were to where you ended up for a few months in your late 30s and to keep on going and not run back to the law, that takes a lot of guts. And I can see why you'd celebrate the day when you finally proved that you're out of that you made it.
Thank you. And you know, it's really at the time, it's me and some pasta. And I, you know, one of the challenges in a startup is, you know, will my decisions have impact on others, not just the company? You're married or whatever in that golden handcuff situation. At the time, I didn't have golden handcuffs so that if it failed, I wasn't going to screw up other people's lives. And I was willing to take the risk because it was my life and there weren't going to be ripples throughout my family and my community. That made that decision easier. I think it's much harder, married, kids, private school, whatever your personal life looks like, because you've got to align all those risks and make sure everyone's bought in that I'm going to take this risk as a unit. And then at that point in my life, there wasn't a unit. So it made the risk, it made it easier to mitigate it, didn't make it any less scary. The problem is you're only accountable to yourself at that point in time. And there's no one giving you checks and balances. So you have to be disciplined to stay on the path yourself.
Let's end this interview on this, Scott. Walking into this interview, it could have been a disaster for me because I got in my head about how I wasn't prepared, how I wasn't prepared enough, how I didn't do as much as I usually like to do and so on. In the past, I either would have gone humana, humana, humana through this interview, or I would have just excused myself from the interview, been honest with you and said, look, I couldn't prepare. I'm not ready. I think I need to reschedule or back out of this. But because I've been doing some work on myself, I'm in a place where no matter how low I get, I hope, I haven't been tested, but no matter how low I've gotten so far, I found a way to get right back to it. It's a meditation process that I go through, and it lets me, whenever I go into deep doubt, find my confidence and go right back up. For you, and first of all, for the audience, it's True Mind Meditation is what I've been doing, and it's been tremendously helpful. But for you, Scott, did you get that place in this start of this interview? Why weren't you thrown? Why didn't you say, hey, you know what, then? I don't want to do this. Or why didn't you have like this sourpuss on your face, like, who put me in front of this? I got to get out of this jerk's webcam. How did you bring yourself to a place where you could be fully present and not second-guessing me, second-guessing yourself, and you know, blowing the interview instead of doing this great interview that you did?
So I also study Zen. So I've been in Zen meditation for about 15 years.
I see.
And so that actually, I think, helps me stay present. I went out and did a meditation about 12:45 for like 5 minutes and just kind of got still and centered. And I frankly use the Zen tricks, and you'll relate to this. I use the Zen tricks in the whiteboards because, you know, being present, letting information pass through, sound, et cetera, passing through you is kind of the state I get into the whiteboards to remain agnostic. I let things pass through without attaching to them, mm-hmm. so I can truly remain open to it. And that's a big trick I use in creating strategy.
So I mean, when you sit down to meditate, if a thought comes through, instead of letting it stick to you or fighting it off, you're just letting it pass through so that you can continue. I see.
Exactly.
And so how does that relate to the whiteboard? You just allow the thoughts to come through you and go on the board without questioning it, without saying, do I spell this right?
I see. You literally put the stuff on the board, you sketch it out as best you can, then you walk away and look back and see what you've done. You figure out the flows, and you're not correcting anything. You're just flowing it. I think it's kind of a trick in life, right? If you're kind of present, you're going to see the opportunities, you're going to see the pitfalls, you're not going to judge yourself too harshly, nor others. You kind of get the chance to let others express themselves and figure it out. There are no guarantees, especially in the startup world. So why are you coming in with preconceived guarantees, preconceived outcomes? You're already cutting yourself off.
Yes.
Does that help?
Yeah, it absolutely does. I haven't been able to put my finger on how it, or even explain it to myself, let alone to other people, how it helps. But I think you've done it right here. And I could see that actually in the beginning of the interview. In my mind's eye, I can see the way you were, and I can understand now why you were like that. And it's an honor to have met you, and I really appreciate you doing this interview with me.
Thank you so much for your time. It was fun.
You bet. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.
Yeah.